This is Bona Haberman. Bona, you've been doing so many interesting things over the years. What interesting things are you doing this year?
Well, I'm still working on a really exciting project, which I call the Mistabra Project for Jewish Textual Activism. The idea is that, well, a lot of people in the Jewish world are looking at texts as the promising source of continuing Jewish culture, where people claim that the textual tradition is the root of Jewish continuity. I think to some extent that's true, but I think the question is not only how that we study text, but how we study text and what values, attitudes, questions, ways of interpreting, and how the study affects the way people live in society, in their families, in their intimate relationships, in the way they organize their communities, and the way they participate in democracy, and the way they understand Israel. All of these questions ought to be brought to bear when we study text, and the study itself ought to have as its aim to influence change in the world, not only to satisfy personal spiritual growth, which is important, but also to engage people in evaluating, criticizing, dealing with difficulties, experiencing the dissonance of the text with their values, with our values, and creatively applying ourselves so that the experience of study mobilizes our passion and our commitment to improve the world.
Do you have an example of how you're working that?
One of the examples that I've been really exercising in the past few years is dealing with the difficulty of trafficking into prostitution, something that Jews unfortunately have participated in for a couple of hundred years already, beginning in the mid-1800s with the what was known then as the global white slave trade, where the impoverished villages, the shtetlach of Eastern Europe, which were dealing with tremendous hardship, became involved in selling their daughters, sisters, and profiting from the sale to places as distant as mainly Argentina and South America, but also China, Japan, Western Europe, and of course also North America. This phenomenon is well documented academically and also in Yiddish literature, short stories. We know of the harrowing trials of these young girls who were sent ostensibly as young immigrants and ended up being taken into brothels and abused in horrific ways. Most of this disappeared during the period of the Second World War and over the Holocaust, but with the massive immigration of Soviet Jews into Israel during the 90s mainly, and into this new millennium, we imported also the terrible practice of trafficking into prostitution, where the networks between Israel and what was the former Soviet Union are extremely strong and fruitful. And so what we have is the places where economic hardship and the after effects of war are causing tremendous difficulty, especially in the smaller towns and villages in the former Soviet Union. Those young women are particularly vulnerable without other economic means and desperate to find ways to support themselves and their families.
And how does that relate to text?
Well, what I find is that most of the approach to trafficking in the feminist and other communities throughout the world is a legalist approach. People are looking for ways to legislate trafficking away. The problem with that is that the phenomenon of relating to a human being as a commodity for use, either for sexual purposes or any other, is a very profound ethical problem. It's not one that can be solved by legislation. It also deals in sexuality, which is, we all know, especially since the advent of Freud and psychoanalysis, that it reaches much more deeply than our pockets. And so the root causes in all of our societies, which enable such an abuse to flourish, need to be addressed beyond the level of legislation. And so the research that I've done at my institute, both at Brandeis and now at Hebrew University, both in teaching and in publishing, as well as the research itself, is to try to understand how society enables or fosters or tolerates such an approach among human beings. And I feel that the deeper level of analysis, where we look into the textual roots of culture, interpret them critically, and try to understand and challenge them in such a way that we can similarly apply that approach to society. So textual activism is where we try to understand how behaviors are formulated in culture, criticize them using ethical values that are constantly in motion and hopefully being refined. And by struggling with difficult sources, we similarly struggle with difficulties in society. And the crossover between the two is extremely potent. Because if we only use analysis which is based at the surface of behavior, then it's very difficult to understand how deep change can happen. Whereas when students and researchers and people from different media, for example, in performance arts and other forms of art, collaborate around themes which touch such profound human behaviors as the way we relate in intimate connections, then the opportunity to evoke the passion to make change happen and to understand our ethical behaviors in a more refined and conscious, intentional way, I feel that this overlaying of text with society is a very fruitful approach.
Do you have a specific text to explain how this functions?
Well, one of the best examples is the story of Esther in the Megillah. Of Esther, we have the case of a young woman being taken from her family and home with all the other young, beautiful virgin girls from throughout 127 states of the Persian Empire and brought to the harem of the king in the capital. And I argued a number of years ago that this is a case of international trafficking of girls into prostitution. It's a kind of shocking way to look at a sacred canon. But the point is that without recognizing the difficulties of the text and understanding the harshness and crudeness of the values that are implicit in it, not necessarily explicit, but reading with a sensitivity to these performances of abuse, then we can begin to interpret and understand how does the text enable the abuse, who's the audience, what kind of action is practiced against the family, the protagonist, that enables the same kind of abuse that we replicate in society. So without intervening in a text like the Megillah of Esther, the Book of Esther, the Scroll, then we replicate a behavior which somehow enables, either at the conscious and certainly at the subconscious levels, this kind of activity to be tolerated and even in some bizarre, macabre way celebrated in the festivities of Purim. But once we uncover these intricacies of the plot, then we start to see, for example, that the racism, which is the main theme we see in the text of the Megillah, is actually based on the misogyny in the first two chapters. In other words, the demand that the king makes for his spouse, the queen, to appear before his drinking party unclothed, and her defiance, which leads to her being taken from the throne, is really the foundation of the later racism, where Haman is in many ways equating the Jews like with women, the women who were insubordinate. Similarly, the Jews are insubordinate to Haman. The way the summary action is taken by the king and the fear of a latent uprising, which is expressed by the king's advisors, lest the women not give proper authority to their husbands in their homes. Similarly, also, Haman is fearful that the Jews will not give proper subordination to their masters, the rightful authorities in the kingdom. So when we look this way, we see that the choice of Esther as king and the way she comes to power and takes a role as a dominant authority who takes responsibility for her people, this is a way of reading the text differently, I would say, against the grain. And I think it unmasks the capability of protagonists to undo or deconstruct power structures which are not necessarily untenable, because they're actually quite tenable, but unethical.
The idea of reevaluating the place of text in our culture, which I understand seems to be part of what you're talking about, I personally find very fascinating, because my experience is that in most cases, most text work, especially here in Israel, is on a very repetitive, particularly inspired level. And I thought for years that the books should just be locked away for, you know, like 100 years in a time capsule, and let the people redigest reality instead of all reality being related back to text. How do you relate to the idea that everything seems to need to be supported by a text? Is that part of what you're dealing with?
The idea of textual activism is a much more vibrant, interactive relationship between text and culture. In other words, the text is not formative of culture. It's not determined by culture either. They're in a very vibrant interaction, or they ought to be in a vibrant interaction. In other words, the text doesn't force action. The text can challenge. It can make suggestions. It can inspire. It can also obligate. But the obligation is not the fulfillment of the black ink on the white page. It's actually the process of interpretation which is the root of the commitment to the text. The text doesn't command fundamentalist authority. The text enables a process whereby we become more active and intentional interpreters of life. The goal of the text is not to command action. The goal of the text, in my view, is to study and enable us to become more thoughtful, refined, intentional actors. The text doesn't dissolve our responsibility. We engage with the text in order to be accountable for our behavior in a more engaged way, where there's a shared discourse among a community of interpreters who might have very different motives, desires, expectations. And in the sharing of the text, we have the opportunity to participate in a discourse which is common to us. Not that the text obligates us to behave in a given way. The text offers us the opportunity to engage with the difficulties of human existence. And through that engagement, we are ultimately responsible. This, by the way, is not a new idea. Rabbinic tradition has been engaging in this process from the beginning of the Oral Torah, which in my view actually coexisted with what we call the Written Torah from the very beginning. In other words, there was never a stage in Jewish experience, or in the history probably of any oral tradition, when concurrently with the text, the so-called canonized text, there were also traditions of interpretation, of midrash, of accompanying understandings, of tacit ways of interpreting. And as these ways of interpreting become more conscious, then we can participate more actively and intentionally. But the goal is not to verify true behavior with the text, but actually for the text to help us open towards refining our behavior in an ever-increasing way, according to how we understand our place in the world.
Doesn't that seem to be somewhat the opposite of what we're experiencing in Israel these days?
Unfortunately, I would say not only in Israel, yes, in Israel, but among the Jewish people, mostly the text is not held in a relation of this kind. First of all, the kind of text study which is an indulgence of spiritual seeking. And I don't in any way mean to indict people who are looking to find fulfillment of a spiritual kind by studying text. But I think one of the main tenets of text study, and it actually says this in the Gemara also, is that it ought to influence action. Studying text is meant to lead to better action. And so the purpose of studying text as an indulgence is only a very partial fulfillment of the goal of text study. And yes, it's true. Text study can be done in such a way that it stifles, that enforces authority, that it leads to fundamentalism, that it seems to be the dictator of truth and good value, an ultimate source. To me, that seems a perversion. In other words, the goal of study ought to be to engage ourselves in change. It's not to acquire new techniques, except insofar as they apply to improving our action and living. And I mean living even at the subtlest levels. It could be in the very profound crevices of spiritual and emotional experience. Changes of that kind are also momentous. And I also refer to changes of the kind that reach as far as understanding the meaning of being a proper citizen in a Jewish democratic state. So we can address text with the full range of human questioning, as long as we understand that we're fully accountable for every moment that we interpret. There's no one who can absolve us of that responsibility. No Rebbe, no teacher, no master, no guru. And texts, unfortunately, are usually studied in most institutions in a way that disempowers the learner. My view is that the text study ought to empower the learner. And wheresoever there's a relationship where the people who study feel dependency and less power, overawed by the magnitude of the Jewish library, then the process of text study is not empowering them sufficiently. That's not to say that mastery and rigorous study aren't precious and important. They are. But ultimately, personal accountability is also significant enough that we need to find techniques that enable people more rather than disable them.
I assume that that's part of what you've been doing in your work at the university. How does that make itself? How do you do that in a practical level?
Well, one of the main ways that I do it is by working thematically with texts in relation to difficult social problems. So, for example, the issue of the relationships of marriage, that's been another area that I've been working on. Not only thinking about the personal intimate relationships, but also understanding the unfolding of Jewish history in terms of the marriage metaphor. It's not something, obviously, that I invented. The prophets all speak very scathingly, especially against the bride who is Israel, the unfaithful bride, the adulterous bride, the bride who betrays her spouse who has given her so much. This is the voice of Ezekiel and of Hosea. This metaphor is also one that extends way past the biblical text and is used in the Talmudic material where we understand the cycle of marriage and divorce as the larger theme, the marriage writ large of Jewish history, where we strive to enter the site of the home, which is understood to be the homeland of Israel, and banished, exiled from the land, divorced from our love, from our beloved, we survived thousands of years in exile. So the theme of marriage is one that really grips the history of the Jewish people from the biblical period until today. The homecoming is understood in terms of the return of the Shekhinah, of the spouse who has been alienated and lost. This is expressed in the poetry in the Piyutim from the moment of 70 when the temple was destroyed and the Jewish people were sent into captivity and exile through the Middle Ages and into the longings of Yehuda Levi and some of the great masters of Jewish and Hebrew poetry. So in looking at marriage, then both in the intimate level and also in the larger scale of Jewish life, we can see a relationship which is, first of all, extremely laden with gender assumptions, where ba'alut, the ownership or mastery, is one of the great metaphors and one of the most problematic ones, and is expressed both in the marriage relationship as we understand it in the tekes, in the ceremony, where the bride is purchased or acquired by an exchange of money. A very problematic conception for us, especially in the modern and postmodern period. And the question is, by becoming aware of how these metaphors, these deeply ingrained cultural metaphors, function, and deconstructing them, we can understand much more of the need for a mutual base for spousal connections among individuals, and also in the way we interpret ourselves in connection with the divine, and the way we understand the return to Israel, also in political terms, where the land is conceived as a woman's body, especially in the Song of Songs, but also in the Torah. We see the portrayal of the fruitfulness of the land, the overlapping of the land as a place which is conquered and tamed and cultivated and is brought to bring fruit and so on. All of these relationships, which are exquisite and erotic, also need to be evaluated in terms of power dynamics. So rethinking marriage, and in the largest scale of history, and also in the very closeness of families, is one way to get a grip on how text and culture intersect and how we can reformulate those relationships that make it possible for us to become more humane and to refine our ethics and to see each other as fully empowered partners in creation rather than dominant partners, one over the other.
It seems that what you're saying has a lot to do with certainly the early Zionist and the ideas and the writings and the poetry and the music and the songs and so on, that in my view at least had were a necessary element in breaking people out of the cycle that they were in of the Eastern, particularly the Eastern European shtetl cycle, and throwing them out of there or attracting them out of there and pushing them into activities which were totally had nothing to do with their lives as they'd been living them for the several hundred years previously. So they seem to be very useful in the Zionist process. What do they do for us now, you think?
Well, the problem with a lot of that early ideology was that it was so heavily gendered. And this is a discourse that goes on, actually. Daniel Boyarin is one of the protagonists in this, where he really praises the identity of the Eastern European, pale, feminized Jew, and criticizes quite dramatically the new image of the Israeli male soldier, militant, Maccabean fighter, and this criticism is in many ways appropriate, in the sense that the gender problem of Israeli male identity, where the heroic battle and the victor and conqueror, the machismo kind of Jewish Israeli identity, is very problematic for Israeli society. That is not to say that the reclaiming of what was a biblical identity of the Jew who brought forth the fruit of the land, who tilled the earth, who worked with her and his hands, that identity was revived by the early Zionists, both the religious and non-religious ones, where the identification of the work of the land as sacred work and the return to the work of hands, manual labor as redeeming labor. This is all beautiful and idyllic and romantic. The problem is where it becomes a gendered dynamic, where the power of the working of the land is and the conquest of the opponent, of the enemy, becomes identified with the male, and the military in Israel becomes such a dominant feature of relationships that extends very far into society, way beyond the domain of what's necessary in order to maintain sane defense and security. So the problem of the mixing of gender with the conquest of the land has generated a really difficult social situation in Israel. That is to say that the military identity of the male Israeli is too dominant. And the question is, how can we create gendered relationships which enable men and women both to participate in Zionism as authors rather than women objects of the Zionist project?
Is there a textual basis for this exploration and an answer to this challenge?
Well, that's also an issue, actually, that I've been working on quite profoundly in the last number of years. And the root, I think, to describe this work has to do with what I call territorialism. The question is, to what extent do the Jewish texts that refer us to the land and the significance of the land of Israel rely on territorialism? One of the key texts for this is a Mishnah in the Tractate of Kelim, which describes the 10 concentric circles of holiness, focusing mainly, of course, on the land of Israel, where Jerusalem among the walled cities is holier, and the Temple Mount above those, the enclosures, and so on, where concentrically the inner circle is the Holy of Holies. Most people read this text to understand a topographical map of ever-increasing holiness, which is directly can be pointed to in geographic coordinates. I don't read the text that way. If we look closely at the text, the first Mishnah there describes the reason for the sacredness of the land being that from her we take the first fruit. In other words, the enclosure which designates holiness doesn't have to do with geographic coordinates, but rather by a kind of attention to the land, which is a human act, depends on human intention. So the fruit, which is designated as first fruit, which is fit for taking into the sacred space, depends on the desire to cultivate a relationship of holiness to the land and its produce. It isn't independent of human action or intention. It derives from human action and intention. So there's not something that's definitively inherent to the land which renders it sacred, but rather the process of interaction between the individual and the family, the community, the process of working the land, how that intention becomes expressed in society that generates the holiness. It's a complete reinterpretation of the text.
So in other words, the specific geography is not the focus of the holiness. I mean, I've always felt, for instance, that land, the earth, is holy, that Yosemite is certainly as holy as any place in the area that we call the Holy Land. Is this partly what you're talking about?
Well, I think that every land, first of all, I'd like to say that I don't think that the authors, the rabbinic authors of the Mishnah in that case, had the intention of ethnocentrically declaring Jerusalem and the Holy of Holies as the authentically and exclusive sacred territory in all the earth. I think that we really need to take the perspective that each culture legitimately has its discourse, and its discourse names and interprets sacredness. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't something specially sacred to the Jewish people about the land of Israel. There is something special, and I would say that it's more attributable to the intention to engage in this space with sacred desire, with longing and yearning, with the will to attract ourselves to living together in such a way that we express the sacred. So it's not that the land is inherently sacred, but it has the potential to enable us to engage in such a way that our lives become refined as sacred practitioners.
All right. Are there any other things you'd like to say about the work that you're doing? I mean, in context or in out of context?
One of the pieces that I haven't spoken about is the extent to which my project uses performance arts. In mediating between the text and society, I've defined this area of performance arts as an opportunity to bring the text closer to life and yet retain the aspect of laboratory. In other words, when we do theater, we have the opportunity to express interpretations, take risks, innovate in the way we approach difficult problems without yet being in a place that's laying us bare to the potential for failure and taking risks that would make innovation much more difficult. In other words, textual activism creates a laboratory for experimenting with social change that's initially safe, that offers creativity as one of the main tools for textual interpretation, and also enables people to practice and rehearse and educate their passions and emotions along with their intellect, so that when they go out of that theater laboratory and they conduct workshops, for example, with youth at risk or in community centers and in immigration centers, they have the strength not only of the intellectual rigor of their study at the university, but they also have the creative and passionate deep grounding, which gives them skills and tools to mobilize other people in their communities to become engaged not only with the text, but with social change. So I wanted to emphasize that element, that the creative arts, music, theater, and performance have tremendous potential as hermeneutic tools, tools for interpretation that can enable people to move the text. Many people, but fewer than the majority, can feel the passion of sitting with a book. But many more people can become engaged with the textual interpretation process when they use their minds, bodies, and souls together. And so I feel performance arts gives us the opportunity to move more people into this realm of discourse and social change than would be possible by sitting at the table.
Do you have a specific example of a performance art piece?
Yes, there are two pieces that my institute created. One of them is called Unmasking Esther. It began as a full-scale theater performance with a musical score, which I created together with other collaborators at Brandeis University. And it developed into community theater opportunities for people to engage in study, first of all. Second of all, to do performance work using the texts and interpreting them theatrically. Third of all, to create a liturgy which addressed this difficult social problem and appealed to the themes and the new interpretations in the text. And fourth of all, to generate social activism suggestions that they could make appropriate in their lives and communities. That's one example. Another one is a performance piece which I entitled Inner Fire, which deals with the issue of Jewish territorialism. It starts in the issue of defining the domain of Shabbat, which is a concept that appears in the Talmudic sources, creating a eruv in which one can observe Shabbat by moving through space and carrying objects. In other words, the concept of Shabbat, which is time, becomes translated into space. And that process of transmuting time as sacred into sacred space is what the second performance deals with. The idea of exercising the text in the dimensionality of community is at the root of this, and also reinterpreting and criticizing much of what we understand today and in Israel as Jewish territorialism with love and respect for the Zionist project.
And how have you made this accessible, say, to our listeners? Is there a point of access for people who are listening and interested in this subject?
There are some publications that have been generated by my institute. Most of all, right now, what I'm looking to create at Hebrew University is an international center for Jewish textual activism, which brings together scholars, students, community activists, performance artists. in order to engage on topics of extreme urgency, particularly to Israeli society, but also in relation to Jewish and Israeli questions that I feel are not being addressed with the creative force that Jewish textual activism could contribute.
I think what I was asking about is everybody has a website. Do you guys have a website? And if you do, what's the address?
The address at Hebrew U is through the Lafer Center. It's www.huji.ac.il/mistabra.
Thank you very much, Bona.
Yeah.